Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, people in England are, as they would say, gobsmacked at the appearance of a yellow orb in the sky. Yes, I know it's hot in California. It's hot in London. Think of it. Ladies and gentlemen, there was much news made this week by the United States Supreme Court. Major opinions handed down at the end of the term, most notably on the Voting Rights Act and the subject of gay marriage or the federal government's treatment thereof. And don't get me wrong, highly newsworthy, both those decisions for one reason or another. But another decision the court made this week made almost no news, even though it's of some importance, some considerable importance, you might argue, to hundreds of thousands of people who had their lives turned upside down in 2005. That decision didn't engender a lot of commentary, a lot of notice, partly because it was about, it was rendered not in a florid set of opinions, minority, majority, dissenting, but it was expressed in only two words. Cert denied. That's the Supreme Court's way of saying they're not going to take the case. The case in question was one that's been discussed on this program. The rather noteworthy situation that came up last year when a three-judge panel of the Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans reversed itself 6 months after it decided that the opinion holding the United States Army Corps of Engineers culpable for deaths and injury in the wake of constructing the Mississippi River Gulf outlet, which destroyed wetlands and led to the funneling of storm surge into the heart of New Orleans. That same three-judge panel, which had upheld the court's ruling, 6 months later said, oh, we made a mistake. We read the law wrong. And the final appeal of that bizarre 180 was expressed in the two words. The fate of it was expressed in the two words, cert denied. The reasoning of the appeals court in reversing itself was that the law provides for a discretionary exception to liability for government agencies. That is to say, if it's in the agency's discretion as to whether to build something somewhere or to paint it blue, you can't sue them for it. So the only possible reading of this decision is that when a federal agency is told by both outside advisors and by experts within its own ranks that what it's doing is dangerous and will affect the lives and properties of the people in the area that it's going to build something in, and the agency ignores that advice, that's cool. That's just discretion. Cert denied. In case you think everything's, as some people appear to do, think that everything's hunky-dory with the Corps of Engineers' work in New Orleans post-2005, contractors have discovered a 15-foot-long horseshoe-shaped crack in the bottom of the concrete barge gate. That was the Corps of Engineers' cost-conscious solution to what to put in the middle of that $1.2 billion wall across the lake that separates New Orleans from the Gulf of Mexico. The crack is likely to delay completion of that surge barrier project. And if the barge has to stay in place because they can't be moved because of the crack, it may change the flow of water through the waterway, affecting navigation and the migration of fish. The crack apparently was caused when the contractor was conducting a test of the barge gate's ability to be sunk in place by filling several ballast tanks on board with water. Officials believe it settled on a piece of debris as it sank. That's the technique that they're going to use during a hurricane. And it hasn't worked yet in all of its testing. the state's Coastal Protection and Restoration Authority has criticized the Army Corps of Engineers for the Corps' attempts to turn over to Louisiana's control completed segments of the post-Katrina system before the entire system is complete. Hey, you pay for maintenance now. But this summer, the beaches in the Rockaways neighborhood of Brooklyn may be more crowded than past years. That's because there's less beach. Sandy made it a lot narrower. And the Corps of Engineers will start to replace that lost sand. The Rockaways will therefore soon become, even more than it already has been, the most expensive beach in America. Sure, we can do that, or at least let us try. Hello, welcome to the show.
Took it, darling, and you tore it apart. You left me sitting in the dark crying. You said your love for me was dying. I'm begging you, baby, baby, please. I'm begging you, baby, baby, please. Turn on the light, let it shine on me. Turn on your love light, let it shine on me. Let it shine, 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 let it shine. I wanna know what I get a little lonely in the middle of the night. I need you, darling, to make things all right. Come on, baby. Come on, please. Come on, baby. Baby, please. Shine on the light. Let it shine on me. Shine on your love light. Let it shine on me. A little bit higher. A little bit higher. Just a little bit higher. A little bit higher. A little bit higher. Come on, baby, come on, please. I'm begging you, baby, I'm down on my knees. Turn on the light, let it shine on me. Turn on your love light, let it shine on me. I feel all right, I feel all right, I feel all right, I feel all right.
Somebody is going to feel even better moments from now. From strangely sun-drenched London, England. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Dateline St. Paul, Minnesota, a Democratic legislator from Minnesota apologized Tuesday for a tweet he sent that referred to Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas as, quote, Uncle Thomas, following the ruling on the Voting Rights Act. Thomas, who is an African-American, was part of a 5-4 majority that invalidated part of the Voting Rights Act. In response, State Representative Ryan Winkler tweeted, SCOTUS VRA majority is 4 accomplices to race discrimination and 1 Uncle Thomas. Winkler, who is white, deleted the tweet and told followers he didn't understand the phrase to be a racist term. Winkler holds a history degree from Harvard. Not teaching history like they used to. Dateline Newark, the former chart-topping rap star known as Fat Joe, heard of him? All right. Was sentenced to 4 months in prison this week over his earlier admission that he failed to file federal income taxes for 2 years. That is so street. His real name is Joseph Cartagena. Apologized to his family and supporters during his sentencing Monday in federal court. The Chinese Football Association has apologized to fans for its incompetence in managing and developing the country's game of football in the wake of a humiliating loss to Thailand and the firing of the national coach. You lost to Thailand? On Monday, the association said it had reached an agreement with Jose Antonio Camacho to terminate his contract, but the association said it's unfair to put all the blame on the head coach. It accepted its inescapable responsibility. Can you imagine an American team owner doing that? President Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono of Indonesia apologized to Singapore and Malaysia this week for record-setting pollution caused by forest fires in his country. For what is happening as the president, I apologize to our brothers in Singapore and Malaysia, Mr. Yudhoyono said. He said Indonesia was working hard to fight the fires, which are often set by farmers to clear their fields. Really? That's where we're at? Still, Mika Brzezinski, co-host of MSNBC's Morning Joe. Yeah, you might wonder why it's not called Morning Joe and Mika if she's co-host. So might she. So maybe she's ticked off. Anyway, she handled an interview with Russell Brand, British comedian on MSNBC, rather oddly, last week. And she's now apologized for the segment. Brand's ire was raised by the insistence of Brzezinski and her two co-hosts. Co-hosts to acting as if they had no idea who Russell Brand was. Lucky them. No, I'm sorry, I didn't mean that. And the trio repeatedly addressed him as if he were not party to their conversation, talk which was condescending and critical. Mika Brzezinski now says she truly had no idea who Russell Brand was before the interview. People come in here one after the other, she said. I've never gotten more vitriol and anger than hatred than I've gotten over this, so I apologize for not knowing. So she's sorry because she got hatred. Dateline Sydney, Australia, the Chabad rabbi at the center of a scandal surrounding his views on allegations of child sex abuse in Sydney 2 years ago has apologized. Rabbi Baruch Leshes, the head of the Sydney Yeshiva Center for 20 years, issued a statement saying he deeply regretted comments attributed to him in news reports, stressing that he encourages victims of abuse to report them to police. The apology came a day after Fairfax Media, which owns The Age and Sydney Morning Herald, released legal recordings of a phone conversation during which the rabbi is heard suggesting boys at the Sydney Center may have consented to sex abuse. Quote, I would like to apologize for statements made in a private telephone conversation that caused pain to the greater public, he said. As I clearly told the caller in a subsequent phone-on conversation, I had no knowledge of the alleged charges claimed to have occurred some 25 years ago and discussed in the news report. The Fairfax report claimed the rabbi failed to inform police of the allegations when he was head of the Sydney Center. It also quoted him, who was heard saying that reopening such cases would be, quote, a can of worms, unquote. MSNBC had another apology this week. They apologized after inadvertently airing unbleeped F-words during the George Zimmerman trial. The camera cut to anchor Chuck Todd after the first words of the statement quoted from Zimmerman's conversation with a local dispatcher, effing punks, these a-holes always get away. Well, said Todd, we've decided we have to institute a 7-second delay. I want to apologize for that language that came out. New Orleans Catholic Archbishop Gregory Amond has apologized for his church's silence 40 years ago when 32 people were burned to death in a bar fire in the upstairs lounge. Staff at the bar answered the door to find that the stairway up to the door was engulfed with flames. It was a gay bar. And these were those days. It's believed that Roger Dale Nunez, who was suffering from a brain tumor, lit the fire. He killed himself a year later. Church and city officials ignored the tragedy, which is the worst mass killing of gay and lesbian people in U.S. history. On the eve of the 40th anniversary of the fire, Archbishop Amond released a statement to Time magazine apologizing for the church's silence at the time. In retrospect, if we did not release a statement, we should have to be in solidarity with the victims and their families. If we did not extend our care and condolences, I deeply apologize. That's an if apology, sir. You want to send a better one to Newsweek? Three of the dead were never identified. Many relatives of the victims refused to claim their ashes out of shame. CNBC host and New York Times reporter Andrew Ross Sorkin apologized to Glenn Greenwald this week. Greenwald, a blogger and journalist who has written many of the stories about Edward Snowden's leaks of NSA-related material. Sorkin had said on the air, he almost wanted to arrest Greenwald. I would arrest him, and now I'd almost, he said of Snowden, I would arrest him, and now I'd almost arrest Glenn Greenwald. Then he repented, did Sorkin. I put my foot in my mouth, and I'm sorry about this. When I veered into hyperbole, that didn't sound so hyperbolic to me, it didn't come out right, and I misspoke. I'm sorry I said it that way, and I'm sorry I said it, and I'm sorry I said. Golfer Rory McIlroy apologized this week for his club-bending incident during the final round of the U.S. Open after hitting his approach shot into the water en route to a quadruple bogey 8 on the 11th hole. McIlroy leaned on his 9-iron and bent the shaft. The pause earlier in the apologies was when I was reading that Russell Brand had, in his embarrassment or anger at his treatment by Mika Brzezinski, gave her some comeuppance over her handling of a microphone and said she was a shaft grasper. So this is the second appearance of the word shaft in the apologies, now that you know. Quote, Rory McIlroy, I just got frustrated and it definitely was not the right thing to do. He said, I wouldn't recommend anyone or anyone watching on TV or any kids to start throwing their clubs or bending their 9-irons. Kids, don't bend your 9-irons. That's from Rory McIlroy. The 9-iron has a new shaft this week, he says, and it's ready to go. Wow, it gets rough there on the golf course, doesn't it? Bending the shaft. Governor Mike Pence of Indiana has issued an apology on his official Facebook page over his staff's deletion of hundreds of comments that disagreed with his opinion on gay marriage. He says he thought staff members were only removing comments that were profane or uncivil, but Pence said commenters were right that all comments attacking his position had been removed. I regret this occurred, said Pence, and sincerely apologize to all those who were affected. That's pound wise and pence foolish, isn't it? Oh, I'm so sorry. Hungarian President Janos Adair this week apologized in Belgrade for crimes Hungarians committed against Serbs during World War II. Never too late, department, and asked for forgiveness for those crimes, underscoring that mutual forgiveness and apologies can strengthen trust between Serbs and Hungarians. Is that what it takes? At this rate, I think all the World War II apologies will be over and done with in about 150 years. Jim Carrey's name may appear in the poster for Kick-Ass 2, the new movie, but the actor is now distancing himself from the forthcoming action comedy sequel on the issue of violence. He says, my apologies to others involved with the film. I'm not ashamed of it, but recent events have caused a change in my heart, referring to the Newtown shootings. And finally, another actor apology. Alec Baldwin has apologized to a New York City-based lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender rights group for a series of tweets that could be interpreted as homophobic. His messages were directed at a newspaper reporter who accused his wife of tweeting during the funeral for James Gandolfini. Yeah? Don't know. Don't know, do I? The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, some news of the godly. For your listening pleasure. Dateline Stockton, California. The Roman Catholic Bishop of Stockton has warned parishioners that his diocese might run out of money before it's finished paying damages to all of the people who have sued over clergy sex abuse. Do I smell a telethon? Bishop Stephen Baer, B-A-I-R-E, will you stop, said in a letter read last weekend to the 35 parishes he oversees that as a result, the diocese might have to file for bankruptcy. A decision would not be made for a few months, according to the Modesto Bee. It's $32 million the diocese and its insurers have so far paid out to settle 34 lawsuits arising from the actions of former priests. Nearly $27 million went to victims of Oliver O'Grady, a former priest who worked in San Joaquin, Stanislaus, and Calaveras counties until 1993 and was defrocked amid abuse allegations 2 decades ago. The consequences will be with us for a long, long time, said Baer. Just 2 days after Pope Francis set up a commission to investigate the Vatican Bank, known in Italian by the acronym IOR, the Institute for Religious Works, a high-ranking priest who worked for it, Monsignor Nunzio Scarano, was arrested in Rome along with two other men and charged with corruption. Father Scarano, aged 35, at the age of 35, ordained after a career as a banker, had already been suspended on suspicion of involvement in money laundering. Now it's alleged the three men tried to smuggle 20 million euro, almost $20 million, into Italy from Switzerland, apparently to avoid paying duty on it. He's known to his friends as the Monsignor, as Monsignor 500 because of the number of 500 euro bills he carries around. In the earlier case, still under investigation, he's said to have withdrawn more than half a million euro from his bank, Vatican Bank account to pay off a mortgage on his home in Salerno. The money allegedly consisted of donations, Tom?
Allegedly.
Thank you. Allegedly consisted of donations by churchgoers who believed it was going towards building a home for the terminally ill. The home for the terminally ill remains unbuilt. And it's been 44 years since Father Mel Hermans sexually abused a boy at the St. Lawrence Seminary in Mount Calvary. I believe that's in Wisconsin. It's been 23 years since a separate case of suspicious conduct involving physical activities with minor males was reported, and 20 years since the Capuchin priest's order paid for the seminary victim's counseling and sent the priest to a treatment center. But he was not removed from the ministry until just last fall, even then with little public notification. Herman's name appears on a list of 23 current and former Capuchin friars removed for sexually abusing minors. It was released only last week as part of an unprecedented audit commissioned by the Detroit-based Capuchin Province, which operates parishes and other ministries in Milwaukee, to assess its sexual abuse policies and come to terms with its history. That's right, ladies and gentlemen, the Capuchins were monkeying around. News of the Godly, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast, and now, welcome, please, our friend the Atom, won't you?
Clean, safe.
Eddie, you wearing sunscreen?
Yeah, it slides right off me.
Okay. Do what you can. A Japanese nuclear power expert said this week that the Fuk nuclear plant meltdown was mainly a man-made calamity rather than a disaster caused directly by a powerful earthquake.
Huh.
Michio Ishikawa, former president of the Japan Nuclear Technology Institute, said the tsunamis triggered by the earthquake caused a 10-day blackout during which the plant's reactors melted down. He said it was poor handling of the blackout that led to the leak. It was the Japanese government and relevant institutes' incompetence that led to the disaster, he said. Attention, Army Corps of Engineers, he didn't mean it. And he wasn't talking about you. TEPCO, the Tokyo Electric Power Company, says radioactive water may still be leaking into the sea from the crippled Fuk No. 1 plant after enhanced levels of radioactive tritium, enhanced meaning increased, that's Dick Cheney speak for increased, were detected in the port area in front of the facility. TEPCO says it's investigating the matter with some urgency, as the finding suggests radioactive water from the plant premises may be leaking into the sea from the ground. Elevated levels of radioactive contamination were found earlier this month at a facility in Washington that treats and manages wastes from the Hanford Nuclear Reservation.
Well, you don't need a reservation.
Okay, I'll go. According to a letter from the waste contractor to the Washington State Department of Ecology, the areas were quarantined, monitored, and decontaminated. No workers were exposed to dangerous wastes, but a watchdog group says there are numerous questions to be answered about the incident. He called on the EPA and the state government to investigate. More about Hanford coming up.
I can't wait.
After failing to reach its radiation decontamination target, the Japanese government has proposed that evacuees from the Fuk disaster return to their own homes and take responsibility for their own safety. The residents called for continued cleanup efforts, but the government officials offered them dosimeters instead. The proposal was made in a meeting between central government officials and evacuees from a nearby district. Under the policy of the government, evacuees cannot return to their homes until decontamination work reduces radiation levels to a certain limit. It hasn't reached that limit yet. But the official, an official said the actual radiation exposure will be measured because, quote, we will offer you a new type dosimeter because we want you to check your exposure radiation by yourselves. The government has spent billions of yen trying to decontaminate a number of areas around the Fuk plant. If the government has an unlimited budget, it can conduct decontamination work until the people are satisfied, said an official of the reconstruction agency. In reality, however, it's impossible to do so. Unquote.
Doesn't cost that much. They're fooling around.
Okay. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission says a Western Pennsylvania power plant had to evacuate a turbine building for about 90 minutes due to excess carbon dioxide. I thought we were going nuclear to get rid of. Isn't it ironic? It's a report from the Beaver County Times. Dayline Omaha, federal regulators say the utility that runs the Cooper nuclear power plant in southeast Nebraska needs to improve how workers respond to problems. The utility hasn't always addressed the root causes of some problems. The NRC didn't provide any specific examples.
It's that root causism.
It is root causism. When Three Mile Island operator Exelon tested its new siren alert system this week, nothing happened. The sirens stood silent. The test was one of two scheduled. The first was the test of the old siren system, which went well. The problems cropped up an hour later when the new alert system was tested. None of the 92 sirens, part of a $13 million upgrade of sirens around Three Mile Island's and Exelon's nuclear station, sounded. These new sirens are supposed to be louder than the existing system and have battery backup, which means they will work even in the event of a power outage. Except for when they didn't work. The officials tracked the problem to a control box, which had not been properly configured.
Configuration is so difficult these days.
It is. The new system, however, worked perfectly when tested last year because it was done so using the manufacturer's computer system, which would have bypassed the control box and the need for the configuration of the thing. Officials say the system will be reconfigured and tested again at a later date.
Stand by for reconfiguration.
I'm glad you're happy. And a new report released this week, actually earlier this month, faults Washington State for lax oversight at Hanford, saying the state employs too few inspectors and gives advance notice of inspections to the federal agency charged with managing the cleanup. This is a report by the EPA criticizing the state at a time when the Department of Energy, which runs Hanford, has been the target of intense criticism of its own because of delays, rising costs, and complaints of mismanagement.
It's a circular finger point.
It is indeed. Kind of fun, isn't it? Clean, cheap, too much finger pointing to meter. Our friend the atom. Addie, go get some sun.
Worst pay, better hours. I was transferred to the moon. to the dentist and told him, take out my heart. I feel better than James Brown. Attending Mardi Gras with Fidel Castro. Buxom cross-dressers threw fake gold coins at our feet as we discussed the fate of the revolution. Suddenly, CIA men dressed in bikinis tried to stab us with fountain pens. Fidel blew mustard gas through his cigar and immobilized the lot of them. 19 tequilas later, we had a deal. Havana goes back to the mob, and Fidel and I open a chain of Kentucky Fried Chicken shops. Ain't life sweet? I feel good. I feel better than James Brown. I feel better now. I feel better than James Brown. I feel better now. How do you feel?
Okay, not bad. From London, this is Le Show. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. I know it was a rhetorical question. And a pre-recorded rhetorical question. A review of top secret NSA documents suggests that the surveillance agency still collects and sifts through large quantities of America's online data, despite the Obama administration's insistence that the program that began under Bush ended in 2011. This, according to the Guardian newspaper, which seems to be leading on this story. They should be arrested, almost arrested. Sean Turner, the Obama administration's director of communications for national intelligence, told the Guardian that the Internet metadata collection program was discontinued in 2011 for operational resource reasons and has not been restarted, unquote. But the documents indicate the amount of Internet metadata harvested, viewed, processed, and overseen by the Special Source Operations Directorate, SSO, inside the NSA is extensive. SSO last December announced what it described as a new capability to allow it to collect far more Internet traffic and data than ever before. The NSA is now able to direct more than half of the Internet traffic it intercepts from its collection points into its own repositories. One end of the communications collected is inside the United States. The NSA called it a one-end foreign solution. It intended the program, codenamed Evil Olive, no joke, for broadening the scope of what it's able to collect. This new system enables vastly increased collection by the NSA of Internet traffic. After Evil Olive deployment, says the SSO, traffic has nearly literally doubled. Another NSA program, codenamed Shell Trumpet, had just processed, as of December of last year, its 1 trillionth metadata record. Metadata, I hardly know her. What could be wrong with Evil Olive? You know? Why would that be? And somebody's off message here. While former NSA Director Michael Hayden was on the one of the Sunday Yak shows talking about the damage that Edward Snowden's leaks have done to national security, the incoming U.S. National Security Advisor has dismissed claims that Snowden has weakened American foreign policy. Susan Rice, oh yeah, said it was too soon to judge whether there would be any long-term repercussions from the intelligence leaks. But she said, quote, I don't think the diplomatic consequences, at least as they are foreseeable now, are that significant, unquote.
Uh-oh. Somebody's in trouble.
News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast, but while on the subject of secrecy, recent leaks of classified documents have pointed to the role of a secret court, a special court in enabling the secret surveillance programs. Members of the court, according to the Washington Post, are chafing at the suggestion that they're collaborating with the executive branch. One judge who used to run the FISA court voiced open frustration at the Washington Post's account of how the court and the NSA interact, according to an inspector general's report published in the Washington Post. In my view, that draft report contains major omissions, said the judge. The inspector general's draft report was leaked by Snowden. It portrays the surveillance court as amenable to the government's legal theory to recreate authority for the Internet metadata programs that had initially been authorized by President Bush without court or congressional approval. The judge is responding. Her hackles have been raised by the idea that the court is cozy with the executive branch, even though the executive branch is the only respondent allowed to speak to the court. There is no defense present. There's no representative of the companies whose facilities might be used in the seizing of metadata. It's purely, as they say in the legal business, ex parte proceedings. And the Washington Post comes up with this interesting detail. Until recently, the secret FISA court wasn't even located in a courthouse. It was located in the headquarters of the Department of Justice. A bipartisan group of 26 U.S. senators has written to intelligence chiefs to complain that the administration is relying on a secret body of law to collect those massive amounts of data on U.S. citizens. These senators accuse officials of making misleading statements and demand that the DNI, the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, answer a series of specific questions on the scale of domestic surveillance as well as the legal justification for it. Meanwhile, on one of the Sunday Yak programs today, Nancy Pelosi on this subject.
Here's the thing. I've been involved in the intelligence side of federal government for a long time. We all know that we have to have a balance between security to protect the American people and liberty. We take an oath to protect and defend the Constitution and the American people.
Oh, Nancy. Oh, Madam Speaker. Check the oath. The oath I found that I think you took, You take an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. It doesn't mention the people. I guess they thought you'd just do that on your own. But you did swear to, you swore to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. Just check the oath, unless they've classified it.
In some friendly countries that we pay. security and safety for all. Our leaders have the right to remain so silent. Memory is what we used to recall. We give away our secrets every day. A red hot date, a charming rescue. Every email, every text, and only Mr. Google knows what's coming next. But they're captured just to keep us secure and stored in a secret database. Then for secret reasons, foul or pure, someone punches save and not erase. Welcome to the United States of Secret, where your loyalty card is worth as much as gold. Our leaders have a right to remain so silent. You never come in out of the cold. Listen. Some drones, but we don't like to say they do their job and then they fly away. Their secret pilots hang at secret bases, putting secret lawyers through their paces. The target lists are secret all the same. Civilians wander on the grid. All boys are men under 40 are fair game. And no one ever knows what we did. Welcome to the United States of Secret. Get some hot facial recognition at the mall. What you don't know is never gonna hurt you. If you've got nothing to hide, are you alive at all?
And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of
AFPAC.
One of the enduring consequences of our involvement in Afghanistan, perhaps, the country is no longer the world's leading producer of opium, poppy, alone. It's now a major consumer as well. You're welcome. Afghanistan was the world's largest opium producer in 2012, churning out 74% of the world's illegal opium, according to the UN. But the Office of Drugs and Crime Representative says it is now more than 1 million drug users. Afghanistan itself has become a consumption country and has one of the highest levels of addiction, globally speaking. You are so welcome. He says the representative says the easy availability of opiates, corruption, and a population now in its third decade of war has resulted in the increased distribution and use of illegal drugs as people try to escape the hardships of their daily lives. It's called freedom, babe. International forces will provide logistical advice to the Afghan military up until 2014, you think? That's what you've been told? I know. It's wrong. The Guardian reports 2020 is the date. This is a British military assessment concluding that Afghanistan's national forces will be unprepared for full operations when NATO combat troops withdraw in 2014. The military advice contrasts with the Prime Minister's approach. We'll see who wins, but it's the military saying probably need some until 2020, you know. The West should have tried talking to the Taliban a decade ago after they'd just been toppled from power. Who says that? The top British commander in Afghanistan. Also speaking to The Guardian. That's after the latest attempt to bring the Taliban to the negotiating table, along with the Americans and the Afghans, came to no good. General Nick Carter, deputy commander of the NATO-led coalition, said Afghan forces would need Western military and financial support for several years after the forces head home. But he said, back in 2002, the Taliban were on the run. I think that at that stage, if we'd been very prescient, we might have spotted that a final political solution would have involved getting all Afghans to sit at the table and talk about their future. Oh, yeah, you had to be real prescient to know that. But he's a general. What do you want? Acknowledging it was easy to be wise with the benefit of hindsight, he said, quote, the problems we've been encountering over the period since then are essentially political problems. And political problems are only ever solved by people talking to each other. So send more weapons, please. But he believes the police and the army had been shaped into sustainable institutions that were strong enough to protect the critical presidential election next year. One academic who studies the Taliban said the group tried to reach out on their own to their and the U.S. governments until 2004 and would have made major compromises. Quote, there would not have been too much negotiating to be done even in 2001 or 2002 because the Taliban senior leadership made their approaches in a conciliatory manner, acknowledging the new order in the country, unquote. Now they tell us. Now they go with the thing. And the people who are paying the price for the killing of Osama bin Laden, aid workers in Pakistan trying to get people vaccinated against polio, Pakistan being one of the three countries that still has, where polio is still endemic, because the CIA put out a cover story that the doctor who helped us, you know that story. Anyway, now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the warm, won't you? Sing it, babe. Mm-hmm. Listen to those waves of vocalization.
We can listen to the war.
Climate records captured in the Siberian cave suggest 1.5 degrees Celsius or 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit of warming is enough to trigger thawing of permafrost, according to a paper given at the Geological Society of London. Permafrost regions cover 24% of the Northern Hemisphere land surface and hold an estimated 17,000 GT, whatever that metric is, of organic carbon. Thawing releases carbon dioxide and creates positive feedback during greenhouse warming. Predicted increases in temperature and drought in the coming century may make it more difficult for conifers such as ponderosa pine to regenerate after major forest fires on dry, low-elevation sites, in some cases leading to conversion of forests to grass or shrublands, according to researchers at Oregon State University. They conclude moisture stress is a key limitation for conifer regeneration following wildfire, which will likely increase with climate change. This will make post-fire recovery on dry sites slow and uncertain. More aggressive attempts at reforestation may be needed, they suggest. Man-made global warming was likely a significant contributing factor in Australia's angry summer of 2012-2013. Did you know about that? According to a new study, it was the country's hottest on record, featuring devastating wildfires as well as widespread flooding. The research, published in an upcoming issue of the journal Geophysical Research Letters, shows that global warming has increased the chances of Australians experiencing extremely hot summers by more than five times and is likely to raise the odds by even more in the coming decades. The study comes from researchers at the University of Melbourne, not Melbourne, and follows the approach taken in other analyses of recent extreme events, heat events. Such fractional attribution studies don't seek a single cause of a particular weather or climate event, but instead examine how some factors may have altered the risk that such an event would occur. For the study, the authors used climate observations and dozens of simulations from nine state-of-the-art computer models to compare summer temperatures in the historical record and in the near future. The human contribution to the increased odds of Australian summer extremes like 2012-13 was substantial, while natural climate variations alone are unlikely to explain the record temperature, the study said. The report found that natural factors actually favored a slightly cooler than average summer in 2012 in Australia, since ocean surface temperatures in the tropical Pacific were slightly cooler than average. It's warmer than average waters, like during an El Niño, that are typically associated with hot Australian summers. So, El Niño is off the hook. Climate change is affecting, altering, and destroying important habitats that America's migratory birds depend on, according to the National Wildlife Federation, reported by McClatchy. The environmental organization warns that a warming climate might lead to declines and even extinctions in some breed populations, and it calls on Congress and the President, oh yeah, to curb carbon pollution. All right, stand by for that. Migratory birds face unique challenges because they require different places to live each season in order to raise their young, migrate, and overwinter. At least 300 species in North America fly to South or Central America every fall and return in the spring. In many coastal wetlands and beach habitats, the rise in sea level has changed where the birds can go. There are signs that climate change is throwing off the critical timing between arrival of the birds and horseshoe crab egg laying. That's what we're worried about, says Doug Inkley of the National Wildlife Federation. Break just wing link of the chain and the entire species is in grave danger. The report also warns the changing rain patterns linked to global warming threaten the Midwest's prairie pothole region known as America's Duck Factory. Ducks such as mallards and pintails face disappearing breeding habitat, according to the report. News of the warm, ladies and gentlemen, it is, as we always say, around here at least, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, on the Mighty 104 in Berlin, on your computer via the internet at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want at harryshearer.com and the news stream of kcrw.com. Available for your smartphone through Stitcher.com. Available as a free podcast at Sideshow Network, iTunes, and KCRW.com. and be just like not thrown off the calendar of the birds. If you'd agree to join with me then, would you, Artie? Thank you very much. Tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, in exile and Hawaii desk. Thanks as always to Pam Halstead, and thanks to Adrian Bodnam at Global Radio here in that crazy thing called Global here in London for help with today's broadcast. Playlist of the music heard here on, the email address for this broadcast, and a fabulous store available at harryshearer.com. And you can find me on Twitter, 87,000 plus people do, at the Harry Shearer. Now here's Vice President Joe Biden.
Harry, I don't have to listen to your phone calls to know what you're doing.
Thank you. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities. I'll tell you that in a minute. If you ever want to find out where streams are of this program on a Sunday, check publicradiofan.com. We come to you through the facilities of the Change is Hard Radio Network.